Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mudiwa Gavaza, and for today, we get into a conversation, around the blockchain, around tokenization, and it's actually something that, we've been following for a couple of years now, the blockchain space. There's cryptocurrencies on the one side, but, people have been getting into representing real world and financial assets through a process called tokenization, and that's the conversation that we are going to be having for today, specifically talking to the team from Four Vismazars in South Africa, just around some of the opportunities that exist in the space. Really exciting to see that we're having a lot more institutional action in the space. I think the likes of BlackRock have helped to increase the value of assets in the space, the activity and interest in the space, and the overall activity that we're seeing specifically on the Ethereum blockchain. To make sense of it all for today, we are joined by Vian Olivier, who is a partner and fintech and digital asset lead over at Four Vismazars in South Africa. Vian, greetings to you today.
Thanks for having me on the podcast today, and an absolute pleasure chatting with you.
Okay, usually I ask about the company, but before we get into that, right, what is it about Ethereum, the Ethereum blockchain specifically, that has given confidence to even the likes of BlackRock to get into a space that just a few years ago people thought was financial voodoo?
Yeah, sure. So I think before we unpack everything in regards to tokenization and where it originally came from, I think what makes Ethereum as a protocol, Ethereum blockchain, as attractive as it is the fact that it's completely open source. So it has all of the credentials that was created the fundamental principles of blockchain technology, being open source and anyone having oversight of the blockchain at any given point in time. It's immutable, it's transparent, and the key thing is not centralized. A lot of people try to erect blockchains in real-world types of situations, but then they forget about the fundamental principle of having that decentralized aspect of it. And there's a famous advocate of blockchain technology, Andreas Antonopoulos, and he always said that as soon as you've got a blockchain that is not decentralized, the only thing that you've got is a very expensive database, because it's kept central, it's managed by a single group of intermediaries. So it defeats the purpose of blockchain technology as a whole. And I think that's why Ethereum is definitely one tick in the direction in terms of why the likes of BlackRock is using Ethereum. But there's also additional functionality to it as well. So with the development of various blockchains, including Ethereum, they brought certain functionalities to the world of blockchain in relation to smart contract functionality and also the ability to create tokens on the Ethereum blockchain. So I think this is where people always get a bit confused. So if you refer to the Bitcoin blockchain capital B, the native currency of the Bitcoin blockchain, lowercase b, is Bitcoin. And the same with Ethereum. Ethereum, for example, it's the Ethereum blockchain, and the native currency of the Ethereum blockchain is Ether. So that's essentially the native currency that you use to transact on the Ethereum blockchain to create smart contracts, to create additional coins or tokens on it, anything of that sort. But I think that is the killer application of Ethereum. It has that functionality to perform multiple functionalities in addition to just housing the native token, which people use from a speculative point of view. So that's the intriguing side of Ethereum, and that's why a lot of people are looking to it. And of course, over the years, Ethereum has gone through a multiple number of upgrades. And I think the most significant more recently was moving away from proof of work to proof of stake and incorporating certain efficiency elements to it, and also making it a lot cheaper to transact on the blockchain as opposed to other blockchains. Now, of course, I can keep you busy for hours in terms of second layer applications and people building blockchains on the Ethereum blockchain. But essentially, that is the reason why Ethereum was so attractive for the likes of BlackRock to actually create something like a tokenized fund on the Ethereum blockchain.
All right. I think that gives us a fair understanding of what's going on and the rationale, for why the Ethereum blockchain has, become trusted is the word that I would use, especially, by more your mainstream type of investors and, getting some of the more traditional guys on board, when it comes to that. Speaking of, traditional guys, Mazars. Now we know you guys as Forvis Mazars, but you guys have traditionally been known as an audit firm. At least, that's how I traditionally knew you guys. Maybe you could just talk to us for yourselves specifically. Maybe you could talk to us about your own shift, towards getting into the world of the blockchain, tokenization, and the types of things that you guys are offering. Either as products, and that's one of the things I wanted to understand. But let's start first with what's your interest when it comes to the blockchain and tokenization, and maybe you could talk to us about your own journey, to actually getting into this space.
Sure. So I think first and foremost, of course, you mentioned Mazars. From the 1st of July. We had the creation of the new network of firms. So from the 1st of July this year, we've known as Forvis Mazars. Essentially, it was a transaction that took place with a US-based audit tax and advisory firm. And effectively, this new network of firms pushes Mazars, which is now Forvis Mazars, into a top 10 audit tax and advisory firm on a global basis. But maybe to take you back into where it all started. So I remember this very clearly back in, I think it was 2018, where as a new partner, assurance partner within the firm, a lot of information gets pushed over your desk in terms of clients to go meet and clients to go see when there's a random cold call inquiry. And of course, this got pushed, or let's say a specific engagement got pushed onto my desk. And I had some experience with blockchain-based digital assets investing from a speculative point of view, and also looking at the use cases and the functionalities of it. So I went out to see the client and had a conversation with the client, came back, and I sat and I thought about it a little bit and I unpacked a bit more. And then I went to my managing partner and my head of audit, and I said to them, there's definitely scope for us to be in this market, because I do expect a more activity in the market going forward, because there's a clear integration in relation to blockchain-based digital assets and the technology as a whole into the traditional financial services sector. And of course, I got to go ahead from there. And then we started to develop our expertise internally. Of course, before we can even look at servicing clients, we first need to make sure that we properly understand the technology, understand the associated risk, and how we would be able to service clients operate in this industry that make use of the asset class. So from there, it was just basically a process of upskilling myself. I did a course through MIT in the US on blockchain innovation. And from there, we landed off our first big blockchain-based digital asset client. And there's no better learning school in the world than on-the-job experience gained. And we serviced the client. It was a client for a number of years. And from there, we got a significant amount of traction and the confidence to approach other individuals in the market as well. And as part of this process, was a continual expansion of our knowledge, of course. So looking at what the industry is doing, look at the various initiatives, how to gain assurance on it, how to be comfortable at, how to eliminate or mitigate our risk to an acceptable level. And slowly but surely, we started to grow our portfolio. So from my own perspective as well, I also completed a master's in blockchain and digital currency to the University of Nicosia. And in addition to that, more recently, I'm also doing my PhD in the development of a framework which financial auditors can essentially use to gain assurance over blockchain-related digital assets when involved in a specific engagement. And you would think that it's just virtual asset service providers that make use of the asset class. But as we see now, the recent couple of years, you see integration of the asset class into various other business models. So let's say, for example, we have clients that hold the asset class on their balance sheet to diversify their investment and, of course, to hedge themselves against devaluation of local currency. So we see elements of that coming through as well. Virtual asset service providers specifically dealing with blockchain-based digital assets is also the type of clients that we engage with. But more interestingly enough, and I always thought the killer application to blockchain-based digital asset would always be for payments, because that was what it was originally designed for. But we see more and more instances of other elements coming into play, such as tokenization, such as fractional ownership, such as real-world assets sitting on the blockchain, even the tokenization of things such as carbon credits and the likes, and the role that smart contracts play in that perspective. So from a Forbes Mazars point of view, the nature of the clients that we service is extremely vast, and we do service these clients on an international basis as well. And I've been fortunate enough to be used as a specialist on multiple other engagements on a global basis that gave me a vast amount of experience in dealing with the asset class and the companies operating in this industry. But from a services rendering point of view, I specifically focus on assurance type of work, which is essentially audits. But there's definitely a need for other types of services, such as tax consulting, such as sustainability, such as tax compliance, all those various elements, internal audit, where I essentially play the role of the digital asset expert within those engagements. So we're able to service clients beyond the realm of purely assurance type of work. And that's essentially where we sit at this given point in time. So we are of course, very active in the market as well, in the circumstances where we engage with clients that meet our specific risk criteria in terms of what we look at to make sure that we service clients in the industry, but do that in a responsible manner as well.
Now, with everything that's happening in this space, Vian, I'm just wondering, right, to say we've seen a lot of development in the space. Like you said, when the idea around the blockchain, you know, first started gaining traction, you know, more than a decade ago, you know, most of us became aware of the underlying technology, you know, because of Bitcoin. And so I can completely understand that for a lot of people, there was always that question, at least around Bitcoin, of, is this a store of value? Is this a currency? And because of those types of discussions, there was that paradigm around, oh, this is going to be great for payments. So I'm completely there with you. One of the things that I'm then keen to understand is, on a fundamental level, it would occur to me that in the real world, nothing actually changes with how assets are dealt with, financial transactions are settled, whether we're talking about the bond or equity markets. We've seen a couple of capital raises that are now being done, you know, through, you know, the blockchain and all of that stuff. But what occurs to me is that it's not necessarily that the fundamental transactions have changed, but rather the underlying technologies that are facilitating these transactions is what has changed. It's the speed, you know, with which you can, you know, make settlements. It's the, you mentioned quite a bit just now. I think you've used the phrase smart contract a couple of times through this session. So it seems to me that the appeal is not that we're doing something different per se, but it's just that we're doing something at a faster pace, more efficiently, and that there's greater accountability because of the transparency that is afforded by the blockchain. Am I understanding that piece of the appeal around tokenization wrong?
No, you've got it down completely, and I'm quite excited to hear you address all the fundamental aspects that make this technology so wonderful. And to your point, blockchain technology is merely another way for us in a more efficient railway for us to use in terms of executing transactions and those types of things. And I think this is probably one of the conversations I like to have most, is to for people to understand exactly how did we get from Bitcoin all the way to where we are today. And if you go back to the release of Bitcoin's white paper back in 2008 by Satoshi Nakamoto, only an individual or group of individuals that we know as Satoshi Nakamoto, release of the white paper and the first Bitcoin transaction being executed on the Bitcoin blockchain back in 2009 after its development in 2008. So the idea with Bitcoin as a whole was to facilitate peer-to-peer payments over the internet without that need for an intermediary, such as a central bank or a commercial bank or anything of that sort. But because of Bitcoin's decentralized nature and the various intricacies involved with it in relation to the engineering, it turned into more of a speculative asset class, and we'll chat about a store value in a second, as opposed to a medium of a payment, a means of payment, which of course it's still useful in today's world. But and the reason for it becoming a speculative asset class is because you've got a global asset class now. You've got the decentralized element of it allows you to execute transactions on a 24/7 basis, 365 days a year. And I've got a colleague in the US that always says the bank of Bitcoin is always open. So it can be a public holiday, it can be after hours, the transactions keep on going. And I think the various macro and microeconomic and political impacts from the various countries also add to the volatility of it. So when you look at something being currency, currency has three elements to it, or three pillars to it. It's a store value, it's a medium of exchange, and it's a unit of account. Now, of course, over the last couple of years, if you look at the Bitcoin price as a whole, you can argue that it's been a store of value because it's been deflationary. It's a medium of exchange because there's a lot of institutions on a local level and globally. You can even pay at Pick and Pay with your Bitcoin. In the US, you can purchase multiple goods and services using Bitcoin. So it covers it from a medium of exchange point of view. But where Bitcoin sometimes falls short is with a unit of account. Now, even though you can pay your groceries in using Bitcoin, the issue there is that they can't price the goods or services in Bitcoin. It's priced in Rand, and of course, it is a conversion that's taking place between the Rand and the amount of Bitcoin that you're going to pay. So that's essentially where it falls short. And with the development such as things like the Ethereum blockchain that allows for these additional functionalities at a speed that scale better than Bitcoin, not, of course, writing Bitcoin off in its entirety. It's still, in my view, be seen as digital gold. But it had this new functionalities that people can start to utilize. So what Ethereum essentially did is they've got one of the changes that they've made was called the ERC-20 introduction protocol that essentially allowed anyone to create tokens on the Ethereum blockchain. So what some of the overseas, mostly US-based players actually did is they created a business model around this. They said for every $1 that lands into our escrow bank account, we'll issue a fiat-backed stable coin on the Ethereum blockchain. So for every dollar that lands in the bank account, $1 worth of Ethereum blockchain, $1 worth of USDT or USDC fiat-backed stable coins is essentially issued on the Ethereum blockchain. So now you've got a situation where you've got an asset class, or rather a currency, a cryptocurrency, that can move over the internet the same way information does, but it can move value over the internet that's pegged to a functional currency being the US dollar. So that essentially resolved this issue from a medium of exchange and a unit of account point of view. So now you can go, you can execute transactions. You're not exposed to the volatility, which is usually presented by traditional cryptocurrencies. And you can use this on a day-to-day basis. And a lot of people say, but where's the real use case? So we actually looked at this at the end of 2022, when one needs to receive payments from a foreign supplier, you can actually ask them if they've got the functionality on their side and you've got the functionality set up in your business to be able to receive payment in fiat-backed stablecoins. And when we executed these transactions, we saw that Once the whitelisting of the address took place, the execution of the transaction takes about 3 minutes to resolve. Once it lands in your let's say Ethereum address, you can verify it on chain because of the open source nature of the Ethereum blockchain, and you liquidate that essentially immediately to South African rands, and you liquidate that into your bank account. So as opposed to following the traditional railways of the payment system, going through multiple banks and interbank settlements, you can execute these types of transactions within a couple of minutes. And usually that payment would have taken about 3 to 5 days, but the payment that we, or the system that we set up to facilitate this payment took about, I think it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We received payment in fiat-backed stablecoin, and we had the rands in our bank account about, I think, 4:15 that day. So you can just see from that point of view, we eliminated all the volatility. We increased the cash flow as well. So those are the elements that we were able to utilize with the development of stablecoins. Now, to take it a step further, people looked at other possibilities. So there was the hype in regards to non-fungible tokens. So we saw the ridiculous amount of money that was paid for artwork,
the NFTs.
I had clients that created NFTs. They made about 40 million rand in 2 minutes just by selling NFTs that they developed. And it was ridiculous, the craze that was going on. And at that point in stage, even though people were making money of it, people were losing money on it, I didn't necessarily got involved into the NFT hype because I didn't really see the value of it. But there was an underlying value. And I always use this example of people playing with Lego. So when you grow up, you play with Lego because it teaches your mind to develop in a certain way, and it teaches you hand-eye coordination, all that. But no one really makes money on a day-to-day basis and paying your bills by playing with Lego. It helped your brain develop in a certain manner. And NFTs did exactly that. They paved the way for people to understand that you can have something like tokenized ownership and tokenization of digital art, tokenization of real world art. And that was a fantastic element to see is how people got to understanding of how this could be utilized going forward. Now, in the background, and fast forward to today, you can see how this developed in something that we call today as real-world assets, essentially, where people can tokenize anything in the real world, and they can put it on a blockchain for people to trade, to invest in, whatever the case may be. And you've got multiple examples. But to give an example, if you want to do a capital raise, as you mentioned previously, in South Africa, you need to list your shares on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, and it's constrained to the confines of the country in terms of who buys your shares. But now you've got a situation where you can tokenize your equity of a business, and you can offer to anyone willing to buy a share in your business. Essentially, you can have a property in New York, which is one of the most expensive cities to own property in, and you can fractionalize, you can tokenize and fractionalize that ownership. So you can buy 10 rands worth of ownership in a property in New York. And looking at various other elements to it, I mean, you see today that we're tokenizing things such as carbon credits, and using the transparency and the trust associated with a blockchain such as the Ethereum blockchain, anyone can validate it. Anyone can have a view of the type of transactions. Anyone can see the transactions being executed. And that's the type of things that we need from an ESG and a carbon credit point of view as well. And of course, that moves into the realm of this element of tokenizing funds, so which BlackRock essentially did. So they set up a vehicle. The vehicle has underlying investments, and it gives anyone, of course, that meets the KYC and AML procedures to invest in that fund and actually own a fraction of investment, similar to what you see in the traditional world from an exchange-traded fund or ETF perspective. But now you've got this element where it can be executed on a blockchain within a couple of minutes or a couple of seconds, depending on the railway that you essentially use. And that, to me, is something magnificent. And that's why we've come from a payments perspective to a store value, to a unit of account, to digital artwork, all the way to real-world assets sitting on a blockchain, which I believe is a significant use case and overlaps very nicely with the traditional financial services sector as well.
Yeah, so one of the things that I'm definitely getting out of this, I like the way that you You know, you provide a lot of context, you know, for why certain things are, you know, especially given some of the historical factors and how one thing has led to another. As you were talking, I was actually thinking to myself that at least when you were talking, if I was to write some subtitles, you know, I would be like, NFTs had to crawl so that tokenization could run.
that's spot on. That's actually brilliant.
But, you know, maybe bringing it to the South African market then, right? A couple of things. Obviously, we're seeing a lot of action happening. You know, we keep using BlackRock. But it's also great because the likes of BlackRock then, you know, put some confidence in the market and also then influence other institutional investors, right? In South Africa, how big is this market in South Africa? It's two things on our side. Firstly, how big is this market in South Africa? And secondly, from the work that you're doing or have been doing, who's actually using the technology? What's being tokenized in South Africa, basically?
Oh, so I think, first of all, tokenization, of course, we talk about tokenization of fiat currencies, as we mentioned, for stablecoins, and the tokenization of real-world assets. And I think it's important from an African point of view that we address both those topics. With Africa having a significantly large migrant workforce to execute the cross-border transactions, the use of these tokenized fiat currencies becomes extremely important, especially in countries as well that have hyperinflation and have a devaluating currency. This is seen to be used a lot in terms of cross-border payments as well. If you think about it, I think the SWIFT fees for a single transaction is sitting over 400 Rand or whatever the case may be. You can bulk them, but these intermediaries charge quite a fee. So you're looking at anything, I think, between 5% and 7% of your transaction being executed. Now, you can use blockchain railways to facilitate that same transaction at a fraction of that value. And I think that is the most important thing for me as an African, is looking at these use cases and putting the money back into the pockets of people executing these transactions and understanding and utilizing blockchain technology to facilitate those types of transactions. I believe for Africa, that is one of the most crucial areas that we need to look at. And of course, it solves that element of interoperability between various platforms that facilitate payments and purchases and those types of elements. So I think that is definitely one of the key areas. From a tokenization of real world assets, sorry, maybe if we just take a step back as well, in terms of that stable coins, of course, as I mentioned, that Africa and South Africa is a large exporter. So when you export goods and services to be paid in fiat-backed stable coins to increase your cash flow of your business as well, that will be a significant player for businesses as soon as they get to a firm understanding of the advantage of that the technology can have for them. But unfortunately, that has been extremely slow. Traditional businesses don't understand the technology. To be quite frank, I don't think some of them are interested in it, and therefore they're trying to avoid the technology as a whole, besides, irrespective of the benefits that it could have. From a tokenization of real-world assets point of view, and I've seen this in Africa quite extensively, there is a handful of players that are focusing on this, and especially I think from a legal point of view to develop these products, essentially to put something in a vehicle that you can tokenize it, that provides the token holders with a right similar to what they would have in the traditional space by owning shares or having a claim on an asset or something of that sort. But that has unfortunately been slow. But I mean, we've only seen the hype regarding the tokenization of real-world assets more recently, as you mentioned, with BlackRock looking into this. So I am expecting this to increase significantly in the near future. But we also see a lot of people looking at tokenization of the South African rand also to utilize that for payments. And I can see in the background from conversations I've had with clients, prospective clients, and industry experts, that there's a lot going on in the background that we're actually not aware of. So either be it from a traditional funds point of view, looking at these elements of tokenization of real-world assets, but also looking and discussing elements such as the share registers of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange or public exchange, actually tokenizing those shares and having it run on a blockchain that's completely automated. So there's no requirement for intermediaries to get involved or anything of that sort. That's also one of the areas that I've heard interest in. But what I am expecting to see as well is from a blockchain-based digital assets and a cryptocurrency perspective, that the banks start and get more involved in this space. So traditionally in this sector, it was the cryptocurrency exchanges, it was OTC desks, it was limited situations of new businesses trying to challenge the status quo. But now more recently, the big boys have got involved. The banks are actually looking at, I think four of the five banks on a research I did a couple of months ago were actively looking at blockchain technology, and they were vocal about it. And they've got departments in the bank actually looking at the technology and how they can utilize it. So I'm expecting to see, and I keep on saying this, but I keep on pushing it out as well. So I would keep on saying by the end of this year, we'll see a commercial bank offer the ability to buy and to store, not to send and to receive, blockchain-based digital assets as part of their service offering to their clients. There's no doubt in my mind that that will come very, very soon. I think more soon than we anticipate, to challenge and to get their piece of the pie of what's currently happening in the sector. But of course, the sector being newly regulated as well, the licensing regime that came out, the banks were skeptical to get involved, but the environment is becoming more mature. The regulator is getting to grips with what's going on. There are certain elements that still needs to be solidified in terms of exchange control regulations and how they're going to track that and prohibit that, and how are we going to share information with transactions being executed, how they will resolve that. I think they're still scratching their heads about that, but I think there is a hell of a lot going on in the South African industry, both from a tokenization of fiat currency perspective and a tokenization of real-world asset perspective.
All right. It is an interesting, the space to be in. And I was just listening to all of the different aspects that need to be in place in a country like South Africa, and especially earlier on when you were talking about the cross-border payments, because I think one of the things that I'm fascinated in is, let's say, mobile payments, for example, right? And one of the issues with mobile payments in certain parts of the continent is that that's the main way in which a lot of people transact. But integrating some of those payment rails into some of the more mainstream payment rails is sometimes a bit of an issue. So, for example, if you have a mobile money account, how do you pay for Netflix or, you know, make an order on Amazon, you know, and that's your settlement option. And it does, you know, seem to me like using a blockchain solution of some sort to translate, you know, one store of value into another, and then it becomes a medium of exchange, you know, would seem to be a viable solution, at least on the continent. And Africa has done a lot in terms of leading thought around fintech and, you know, just completely different ways of how do you settle payments that, you know, it seems realistic to me. You know, maybe I'm wrong, but you can tell me, you know, am I flying too close to the sun with this idea?
Yeah. So look, I think that's something that we have discussed in quite length in the past as well. And you're 100% correct in saying that with mobile money and payments, and once again coming back to Africa's migrant workforce being a big factor, but the amount of people that is underbanked in Africa is extremely significant. And the reason for this is the hurdles that they need to overcome to be able to utilize a bank account or to get a bank account. And then in addition to that, there's the issues in terms of the infrastructure as well, as whether that infrastructure is available for them to transact on an ATM or to withdraw cash from an ATM or anything of that sort. And I think that's where if you look at something like Kenya, and Kenya was fantastic in terms of the M-Pesa and how they utilize that. But the reason why M-Pesa was so successful was as a result of the network effect and as a result of mass adoption. So everyone in Kenya essentially utilizes M-Pesa for their day-to-day transactions. And having that ability to transact with anyone or any business at any given point in time significantly increases that adoption as a result of that network effect. It has value because more people are starting to use it. And it goes back to the same fundamental principles of blockchain technology. It's something like Bitcoin has value because other people believe it has value. It's reflexive in nature. From a payment point of view, utilizing technology is definitely one of the use cases. But I think, as I mentioned or alluded to previously, that interoperability aspect of it is where I think there's definitely something to look at. Because even though you've got something like an M-Pesa and maybe you've got a vendor selling something that uses a different platform, and you can't directly use M-Pesa to pay someone or to receive funds or whatever the case may be, you can use whichever blockchain, of course, you want as that element of to solve that interoperability. So it essentially act as a trustless, verifiable and transparent middleman between these two merchants to be able to execute those same transactions. And I mean, once again, that gives anyone the capability that wants to receive money or to make payments, whatever the case may be, to do so freely without the constraints of an underdeveloped infrastructure or underdeveloped market. Because at the end of the day, if you think about it, and I love seeing this in real world instances. So my gardener, for example, he's from Malawi, and he couldn't open a bank account. He was battling to open a bank account for, I think, 2 or 3 years or whatever the case may be. But he had a mobile phone connected to the internet and he was able to do everything else on the mobile phone. So one day when I wanted to pay him, I got tired of going to the ATM and drawing cash or whatever the case may be and paying him in cash. I said, but can't we do a money send? So I can send money to a specific point and then you can just use this PIN and you collect the money over there. But the banking rail that I was using only facilitated that with Pick and Pay. And he said, there's no Pick and Pay close by to him. But then where we could have solved this is for me to pay him in rand-backed or dollar-backed stablecoins if he had a wallet. But once again, the acceptance in South Africa, and acceptance is growing, of course, isn't where it's supposed to be. So even though you can pay certain merchants and you can pay certain individuals in fiat-backed stablecoins or unbacked cryptocurrencies with Bitcoin and Ether, that's that acceptance that's needed in the end of the day. And that seems to grow over time. I mean, there was a recent article now in relation to payments with Pick and Pay. So Karel van Wyk, who created Money Badger, that essentially facilitated these payments on, the use of Bitcoin and the Bitcoin Lightning Network to facilitate payments at merchants such as Pick and Pay. I think originally they were seeing something like 25,000 rand per month that was of groceries or electricity bills or airtime being purchased in a month, and that shot up now to a million rand. And you can see from that point of view is how exponentially the adoption has grown in the last, I think it's not even 2 years, if I'm correct in saying that, if how more and more people are utilizing the asset class to facilitate payments. And of course, Pick and Pay being a massive player in this game, a lot of people will follow suit with them as well and see, well, should we not look at the possibility of allowing this to be paid in any type of stable coin or any type of cryptocurrency? Because the conversion that you can facilitate on the merchant side can be immediate. But what's required to do that is more people to buy into the idea and to buy into the concept, and to do that, I think there's a fundamental drive of understanding the technology and educating the general public in terms of the risks, but also the possibilities and the opportunities then that open up when you're using something or a platform or tool to make these payments using a specific blockchain or additional networks such as the Bitcoin Lightning Network, for example.
All right. So that's where we Unfortunately, have to call it a day on this conversation. It has been, you know, quite an educational one around tokenization in the world, and bringing a lot of historical context into the journey that's been taken. In this particular aspect, you know, just some of the history around the blockchain. Our changing mindsets from, you know, perhaps this is great for payments, you know, towards the fact that actually, you know, we could get to a stage where we could represent real world assets, you know, using these digital tokens, and encourage different types of transactions, you know, from that point of view. Starting off with just talking about the value and the appeal of the Ethereum blockchain specifically, you know, Vian just giving us some insight into, you know, why that particular blockchain has done well in, you know, at least instilling a measure of confidence among some of the more traditional players, you know, and then also giving us some insight into, you know, how then that has then shifted into different things happening. Obviously, it's the point that I hadn't heard anyone making, you know, but it was great to hear the fact that, you know, NFTs were actually useful for something, you know, albeit, you know, being a bridge, you know, more than anything else to making the normal person on the street understand that you could represent something digitally using blockchain technology. And, you know, this has helped, you know, with part of the thinking, you know, around some of the adoption that we're seeing, you know, in the world right now. Also giving us some insight into South Africa, where do we sit? He's saying that there has been a lot of progress, a lot of movement, you know, in the space. We're seeing a lot more interest, a lot more adoption. He expects that it's not too far down the line that we're going to start to see at least the stable coin type of transactions starting to happen, you know, as the banks start getting on board. And I would agree with him. I'm not an expert, but one of the things that he spoke about is, you know, network effects. And, you know, when you think about the numbers that the big banks have, you know, when they then come on board with some of these things, you know, you then have the potential, at least the opportunity, to have even more people becoming aware of the technology and, you know, making use of it. And it could help us to solve some of the real world issues. Let's use the example of, you know, being able to pay a helper or a gardener that he was giving, you know, just now. Some of the cross-border payment aspects that we were speaking about earlier on. But he does say that as much progress as has been done, there is still a long way to go, particularly, you know, in South Africa. A lot of mindsets still need to be changed. A lot more of the traditional institutions still need to come on board. So that's where we end off. It has been a really great discussion, just talking to Vian Olivier, who is partner, fintech and digital asset lead over at Four Viz Mazars in South Africa. Vian, thank you so much for being with us today.
Only a pleasure. Thanks for having me on it, and I look forward to the next conversation.
And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So from myself and the rest of the team, it is a good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.